I've experienced tremendous skepticism because people are confused about what nonviolent conflict is. They basically say, oh, you're talking about nonviolent conflict. What do you think you're going to do, is convert the dictator? But nonviolent conflict is not about converting the dictator. It's about throwing him out.
We appear to be heading right over a fiscal cliff. Is there anything in the administration's policies that would suggest that we have any chance of avoiding that? The answer is no. So, no, this is crazy. I don't know if there's any government in history that has ever cut taxes in the face of spiraling military expenditures.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, September 17th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat offered a new truce to Israel today after Palestinian officials said the militant group Hamas has signaled it might agree to stop attacking Israelis. Interviewed on Israel TV's Channel 2, Arafat was asked if there was a possibility for a ceasefire. Of course, he said, you're invited. The announcement was made yesterday, referring to remarks by his security advisor. In an earlier interview on Israel's Channel 10, Arafat said contacts were underway with all Palestinian factions over a ceasefire. He said there are continuous contacts with various parties. Yesterday, I had a meeting with all the PLO factions. Even the Islamic Jihad said they are willing to respect a ceasefire, and we are continuing our contacts with Hamas inside and outside, said Arafat. There was no immediate comment from Israeli leaders, but the government said yesterday it wanted to see the Palestinian Authority begin disarming Hamas and other militant groups before it would consider a new truce. In an audio tape broadcast today, a speaker purporting to be Saddam Hussein urged Iraqis to escalate attacks on Americans and called on U.S. and other coalition forces to leave the country, quote, as soon as possible and without any conditions. The speaker, who sounded like the ousted Iraqi leader, also urged America's international partners not to fall prey in the traps of American foreign policy and reject any plan for Iraq that legitimizes military occupation. With the federal deficit looming larger and larger and the Congress considering Bush's request for an additional $87 billion to wage the war in Iraq, Peace Watch spoke today with Paul Krugman, economics and international affairs professor at Princeton University, for his analysis of the U.S. economy. Krugman is also an op-ed columnist for The New York Times. We started by asking him to explain his statement that there is a disconnect between the official claims of the Bush administration and reality when it comes to Bush's economic policies.
Just as we've been sold tax cuts on a constantly shifting basis, but on the belief that they would be affordable or that they were for the middle class or that they would be just what the economy needed, all of which were untrue, we were sold a war in Iraq on the basis that it was a direct blow against the people who did September 11th, or it was in response to weapons of mass destruction, or in any case it would be a pushover and wouldn't really impair our other efforts, all of which turned out to be untrue. My general insight here has been that there's a common character to the administration. Foreign policy looks the same as domestic economic policy.
In the introduction of the book, you said that people tend to look at proposed Bush policies or actual policies and say, well, they don't mean that. There's really no way they can take it that far. And time after time, you see things that, like one tax cut after another while we're prosecuting a war in Iraq. Now, Paul, you assert that what we see is part of a revolutionary power that is sweeping the country. Elaborate for us. What exactly do you mean by that?
What I mean is that the goals of the people who are calling the shots, which isn't necessarily Bush himself, but the people that to whom he defers, are very, very radical. And if we look at across a broad range of policies, we discover that they are, in their own words, have goals that are very much at odds with the way this country has been run the past few generations.
For example,
the most important Republican lobbyist in Washington, this man named Grover Norquist, who has said that he wants to roll back all of the social programs introduced since the 30s. He wants to bring us back to a government that does no more than it did in the times of President McKinley. He talks about shrinking the government to a size where you can drown it in the bathtub. And it turns out that he's not alone, that the Heritage Foundation, which is more or less the intellectual headquarters for these guys, has the same view. Now, that's a radical revolutionary agenda. It's not very hidden. It's not what Bush says he's going to do in his speeches, but if you look at what his policies are achieving in terms of gutting the revenue base of the federal government, that's pretty much where they're pointing us. Similar thing on foreign policy, since we're going to talk about Iraq. If you had taken a look, you would have discovered that many key officials in the administration, up to and including Dick Cheney, have been advocating an aggressive foreign policy, with the first step in that implementation being an invasion of Iraq, for more than a decade. And it should have been clear that this Iraq war was not about responding to 9/11. It was about getting a chance for these people to do what they always wanted. You can find similar things looking at environmental policy or at health policy. It's just a really much more dramatically, maybe it's a counter-revolution, but a revolution against institutions that we've had so long that they've become part of what America is all about, but these people want to get rid of them.
Hmm. Well, the war in Iraq is costing approximately $4 billion, with a B, dollars a month, and that works out to about $30 million a day. How much do you think the war will cost overall, and how long do you think we can keep spending at this level?
Well, the war itself, one way to say it is, well, it's probably running about $100 billion a year with all things taken together, and, well, that's 5% of the federal budget. It's 1% of GDP, and you could say, well, that's a lot, but it's not intolerable. But of course, it comes on top of a already record alarming deficit. It comes in conjunction with tax cuts, which are much more of a direct burden on the budget than the war. But the other thing I've learned is that the direct costs may be the least of it. If you talk to people in the military or recently with the military, they say, we cannot, with the current sized army we have, maintain this pace of commitment. And so if we're really going to do this, we need a much bigger army. And then we're talking about real money. Then we're talking about a disastrous burden on the budget.
Mm. And so what is the overall effect of this current wartime spending likely to have on the economy?
Well, in the very short run, spending, even if it's wasteful, does create some jobs. This is not the best way to do it by a long shot, but in a narrow sense, the war, as opposed to not spending any money, is probably a slight stimulus to the economy. One of the mysteries here has been how they can run this big a budget deficit and create so few jobs. It probably is some slight positive. In the longer run, well, you know, our budget is way, way out of whack. We're not talking about, oh, well, we've got a deficit, maybe we'll grow out of it. We're talking about a level of irresponsibility that is really the kind of thing you associate with banana republics.
Well, what kind of figure are we talking about?
Well, right now we're running a deficit which is about a quarter of total federal spending. And in a way, that's an understatement, because we know we have the future liabilities of Social Security and Medicare out there. And if you take Social Security, both the receipts and the spending, out of the thing, then we're left with a budget deficit of more than a third of total spending. So the roughly 35 cents out of every dollar that the federal government spends now is being borrowed, with no prospect that that gap is going to narrow significantly. You can't do that for very long. At some point, the people basically stop lending you money. People say, this is, we don't think that you're a good risk for repayment. Mm-hmm. And we really are talking, these are numbers that look comparable or worse than Argentina before its recent crisis. It's going to take a while before people, including bond investors, are willing to admit that the United States has turned into a banana republic, but by the numbers, it already is.
I thought I read somewhere that the projected deficit for the U.S. was upwards of $500 billion.
That's right. We're talking $500 trillion plus deficit. Some people are even saying possibly up to $600 billion, because that $87 billion we all heard about was based on optimistic assumptions, including assumption that our allies are going to come up with a lot of aid money, since we've treated them so nicely after all.
Well, I'm not an economist, but I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding how the country can afford tax breaks while we're running a projected $500 billion deficit. How does that work?
Well, we can't. I mean, we can get away. The U.S. is so big and so rich and has such a long history of stability that it can get away with almost anything for a little while. So even if it's running an absurd budget deficit, people will lend it the money for a while. But if you actually ask, is there anything in this administration's policies that would steer us away from the cliff? We appear to be heading right over a fiscal cliff. Is there anything in the administration's policies that would suggest that we have any chance of avoiding that? And the answer is no. So, no, this is crazy. Nobody, I don't know if there's any government in history that has ever cut taxes in the face of spiraling military expenditures. Mm. This is a bizarre, irresponsible, and deeply dishonest policy.
Well, now, you said a little bit earlier that the war would actually stimulate the economy a bit because of the jobs. And there's an ad in the New York Times running today on MoveOn.org that says Bush is the first president since Hoover to preside over an economy that has lost jobs, not created them.
That's right.
More than 2.9 million jobs. 2.9 million jobs lost since 2001.
That's right. And a few jobs may come back in time for November 04, but it's more or less impossible that he will fail to end his term with fewer people working than when he started. What this comes down to is having a deficit probably tends to sustain some jobs, but never before have we run a deficit that has done so little to create jobs in the economy, because the deficit is driven overwhelmingly by tax cuts for upper-income people who are the least likely to spend that money in a way that creates jobs.
Mm. So let's look a little down the road. With the deficit looming larger and larger each day, where do you see the economy in 10, 20, or 30 years from now? Over that cliff?
Well short of that, I think. I think by 10 years from now, the baby boomers will already be retiring in large numbers, which means Medicare and Social Security expenses go soaring. I think well before that happens, the financial markets are going to deliver a wake-up call. They're going to say, we don't trust the U.S. to repay money that we lend it, and so they will actually be forced to do something. So we're headed for a crisis. We're headed for a point when interest costs for the U.S. government soar, when it just can't raise the money. And something drastic has to happen, either a default on the debt, which that's, of course, we think of as impossible, or a really major tax increase, rolling back everything Bush has done and then some, or drastic cuts in programs that middle-class Americans count on, like Social Security and Medicare, which also sounds inconceivable. All of those things sound inconceivable, and yet one of those things has to happen. And if I look at the level of political deadlock in the U.S., I actually suspect that we may well have at least a period when the U.S. government isn't paying its bills, and it'll be a nightmare scenario.
Well, how will that feel and look and manifest to Americans?
Oh, chaos! Breakdown of basic services, at least for a little while. I don't think water and electricity, though. After recent events, you can't even be sure about that. A situation of drastic, abrupt cuts. Teachers and federal employees going unpaid. It's very hard. Chaos is very hard to predict, but what it looks like is a scenario in which the smooth running the government is just not going to be happening. Mm. And of course, that takes a terrible toll if it occurs on business confidence, on consumer confidence, the whole thing. It's going to be very nasty. I just think that we haven't just seen policies I disagree with. We've seen an inability on the part of the people running the country to face up to reality when it doesn't fit their preconceptions. And that suggests to me that we have to actually hit the wall before something changes.
And so whoever is in the White House in 2004 will need to have some pretty far-thinking, some pretty clever plans.
It's not hard to say what we need to do. And the resources are actually there. Well, this is still a very rich country. We have a lot of capability. The trouble is, I would imagine that if it's Bush reelected, there's no reason to think that he'll be any more responsible after 04 than he is now. And if it's a Democrat, the odds are it'll be a Democrat who will still face Tom DeLay running the House of Representatives. And DeLay is really a fanatic. So you have a very hard time envisioning any kind of compromise, any kind of workable relationship.
Paul Krugman, in a recent interview for BuzzFlash, an online newsletter, you were critical of the media, saying that if a journalist works for a Murdoch publication. They are basically part of a propaganda machine. That's a little harsh. Can you give us some specific examples and why you say that?
Oh, well, there's so many examples, it's hard to pick. But certainly, if you got your picture of the world entirely from Fox News, you would be getting a truly distorted view of what's going on. Two examples from the Iraq War, just to give an example. In advance of the war, there was a demonstration in New York, right outside the Fox offices, as it happened, which included several hundred thousand people.
February.
If you had been watching Fox, you would have heard, oh, it's just the usual professional protesters out there. they pretended that the whole thing didn't exist.
Mm.
During the war and in the immediate aftermath, Fox repeatedly announced the discovery of caches of weapons of mass destruction, and never put out a bulletin saying, after any of them, as far as I can tell, saying, whoops, false alarm. So you might well imagine, it's not so hard to imagine, to understand why such a large fraction of the public believed for a long time that we actually had found those things, or why so many people believed that Saddam was involved in 9/11.
So connect the dots. What are the news organizations that work for Murdoch?
Murdoch organizations, the most prominent would be Fox News and the New York Post in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically what we're looking at. And, of course, the Washington Times is another, is the Reverend Moon's organization. And so there's a heavy politicization of the press.
Mm-hmm.
What I find a little upsetting and alarming is that the mainstream, non-Murdoch media, although they aren't part of the machine in the same way, don't do a very good job of keeping these guys honest. One of the columns that's in the book, in The Great Unraveling, I said that if Bush said that the Earth was flat, of course Fox News would say yes, the Earth is flat, and the mainstream media would say have a headline, "Shape of the Earth, Views Differ." And that's kind of the way that our news is reported.
Mm. So what are some of the ways that you feel that these mainstream corporate media are pressured to conform to sort of toe the administration's line? Or,
well, to some extent it comes from the top down. To some extent there's and I have only fragmentary pictures of this, but there is subtle or not so subtle pressure from the corporate owners saying we don't want to be hearing any Bush bashing. We want you to be part of the effort that we expect you to be patriotic, where patriotism is defined as going along with the administration.
Have you personally come under attack for you?
No, not from my management. Now there's the other side, which is that there is personal harassment of journalists who don't toe the line. And we're not talking now about your management. We're talking about organized letter campaigns.
Your mail.
Your mail, the mail your editors receive, the mail your bosses receive, determined efforts by people to see if they can find some scandal with which to discredit you. It's a very unpleasant experience. Most journalists get a kind of warning shock the first time they say something critical about Bush, and they get very cautious after that.
Have you personally come under attack?
Oh, yeah. You name it. My mail has to be picked up with tongs. There was a concerted effort to blow up some perfectly innocent consulting stuff I did before I worked for the New York Times and make it as if it were somehow scandalous. It's a good thing my personal life is boring, because it really is unpleasant.
Veteran correspondent, war correspondent, Christiane Amanpour of CNN said recently, it may have been earlier this week, about media coverage of the war on Iraq. She said, quote, "I think the press was muzzled, and I think the press self-muzzled, I'm sorry to say, but certainly television and perhaps to a certain extent my station was intimidated by the administration and its foot soldiers at Fox News. And it did, in fact, put a climate of fear and censorship, in my view, in terms of the kind of broadcast work we did." And then the Fox spokeswoman, Irina Briganti, said in response to that, she would rather be a foot soldier for Bush than a spokeswoman for Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, which is incredible on multiple levels. It's not just, of course, that they're implying that anyone who isn't 100% behind Bush is on the other side, but also, Saddam Hussein is not Al-Qaeda. This was part of the whole question was, how did we get to, why did we pick this enemy? Why are we going after someone else? And so Fox is, well, you see the pattern.
Misinformation.
And look how scary it is. Here it is. Someone expresses some really quite modest regrets about news coverage and is very nearly accused of treason.
Well, I'm not so sure that was modest. If you're saying you think the press was muzzled,
well, but,
and that the administration intimidated you.
Yeah, but the press was indeed muzzled. I mean, it's not a subtle issue.
In addition to which, you had the whole situation of reporters being so-called embedded for the first time in history.
Well, yes. Now, that needn't have been a disaster. It needn't have been as bad. It could have been something like what happened in World War II, where reporters were on the front and got to report. But in fact, it turned out that the embedding was something much worse than we had imagined. It was it did turn soldiers into propaganda arm of the military.
Do you think, Paul Krugman, that there is something that the average citizen can do to force their local media outlets to be more balanced, more aggressive in their coverage?
I think that mailing and that writing letters and sending emails actually works. Part of what's happened is that the media receive what appear to be a grassroots objections whenever they present a view that doesn't follow the hard right's agenda. Some of that isn't really grassroots. Some of it is what they call astroturf. It's fake grassroots. It's actually organized. Some of it is spontaneous, where people who listen to Rush Limbaugh and then go off on the warpath. You can't stop that from happening. We have it's a free country, at least so far, with free speech. But you can try to provide a counterweight. And I think that when editors receive a raft of letters defending a reporter who said something controversial or attacking a reporter who has clearly taken a partisan position on behalf of one side, it does influence their future reporting.
But now, so you think that it's important to write in when you support what the reporter is saying, that when a reporter says or does something controversial?
Yeah, if a reporter says, gives what appears to be honest reporting that makes powerful people uncomfortable, writing in support, saying thank God for Jane Doe's and her courageous reporting, I'm glad your paper is willing to print such a thing. That's a very that I think helps quite a lot. I think communication, anything that gets in and makes it clear that there is in fact a constituency. One of the things that has really struck me is that until very recently, I believe that a large number of Americans have been very upset at what's been happening these past 2 years, and until a few months ago, it was very hard to hear from those people. The existence of the dissent was largely suppressed and wasn't covered. And to some extent, it's still true, although it's breaking out more into the open. So I think encourage the media to recognize that there really is a diversity of opinion in this country.
Paul Krugman, the author of The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century. Any final thoughts on your part, Paul?
Just to say that I think there is, in the book I talk about a great revulsion that I hope for, where people finally say, we've been used. Our goodwill, our patriotism has been abused, and that will turn things around. I don't think the great revulsion has come yet, but I think there is a great awakening taking place. It seems to me, looking at a little bit of media coverage, looking a lot at the kinds of books that people are buying this fall, that people are waking up, and I hope it continues. We may still be able to save this country.
Paul Krugman, professor of economics and international affairs at Princeton University and op-ed columnist for the New York Times. He's also the author of The Great Unraveling, Losing Our Way in the New Century.
Thousands of years ago, in ancient China, A boy emperor ruled for a while. The imperial court had placed the child on the throne so that he could be a mouthpiece for the imperial court's desires. Coddled from birth, surrounded by servants and sycophants, told by the imperial court that he was the son of heaven, given to believe he had no obligation to anyone but his imperial court, pampered and protected from any notion of what the real world was like, from any idea of what the people had to put up with every day. The emperor stomped and swaggered through the world, telling the people what to do, taking whatever he wanted, robbing from the poor and giving to the rich, and sending his armies out to terrorize whomever he took a notion to despise. The emperor ruled for a long time, and hundreds of thousands of people died, killed by his armies and because of his abuse and neglect. But eventually, after great suffering, the people rose up and crushed the man who called himself the Son of Heaven, and they crushed his imperial court as well. Then some time passed in which the people lived in relative calm, until another emperor, like the one in this story, came along.
Musician and activist David Budbill from his album Songs for a Suffering World.
Hi, I'm Lona Elias, the editor of Peace Watch. It is only through your financial support that Peace Watch can continue. You may make a contribution through our secure website by logging on at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. In this political climate, the question is not whether you can afford to support Peace Watch, but whether you can afford not to. Please log on at www.pacifica.org.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.